Good morning, everybody. Hope y'all enjoying this weather. It is nice out. What a relief. So, now that we talked about something pleasant, let's talk about something unpleasant. Judges chapter 21. Yes. Yeah, I can. Here, I can blow everybody's ear out on the recording. Yeah, it's on. All right. Judges chapter 21. We have seen Israel. We've seen this situation unfold, and it starts off just about as horrible as you can imagine with what happens to this poor Levite's concubine in Judges 19. Then it turns to civil war in chapter 20 because the tribe of Benjamin is they're going to go to the mat for the city of Gibeah. And we saw how the Lord so Israel consults with the Lord, they inquire with him, and he tells them, go up and fight. He also gives them over into Benjamin's hand for 2 days in a row, because as we pointed out last week, this is judgment going all around. All right, this is not just the Lord's judgment on Benjamin, but this is going to be the Lord's judgment on everybody. And by the end of this, if you tally up the numbers, I think the first day Israel loses 22,000. The second day they lose 18,000. So they've lost 40,000 men. They actually end up losing more than Benjamin does. Benjamin loses about 25,000. Although proportionally we'll see that Benjamin suffers the greatest percentage of casualties. But again, there's judgment all around. This whole thing is a mess. So far, we've not seen any kind of happy resolution to this story. In fact, the very last thing that we read in chapter 20 is that all the towns that they found, they set on fire. All right, we're going to come back to that in just a second. Let's start chapter 21, verse 1. Now, the men of Israel had sworn at Mizpah, none of us shall give his daughter in marriage to Benjamin. And the people came to Bethel and sat there till evening before God, and they lifted up their voices and wept bitterly. And they said, O Lord, the God of Israel, why has this happened in Israel, that today there should be one tribe lacking in Israel? And the next day the people rose early and built there an altar and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings. And the people of Israel said, which of all the tribes of Israel did not come up in the assembly to the Lord? For they had taken a great oath concerning him who did not come up to the Lord to Mizpah, saying, he shall surely be put to death. And the people of Israel had compassion for Benjamin, their brother, and said, one tribe is cut off from Israel this day. What shall we do for wives for those who are left, since we have sworn by the Lord that we will not give them any of our daughters for wives? All right, so this sets up the problem of chapter 21. Israel has sworn this rash vow against Benjamin that now they pretty much immediately regret. Right? They've sworn none of us shall give his daughter in marriage to Benjamin. But that is immediately turned into a problem. Right? And that's we find that expressed in verse 7. What shall we do for wives for those who are left, since we've sworn by the Lord that we will not give them any of our daughters for wives? And of course, this should remind us again of another parallel in the book of Judges. Who else infamously makes a rash vow? Jephthah. And we should note, by the way, that the same remedy is available here that was available to Jephthah. Jephthah's got a problem because of his rash vow. The law provides a solution for it, like we saw when we studied Jephthah. Israel has done the same thing. They have created a problem for themselves. And we're going to read over the rest of the chapter is a description of at least a couple of different completely, we just got to say stupid ideas that Israel has. All right, they come up with just harebrained schemes to solve this problem that they have created by their rash vow. We should also consider, by the way, the way that Israel is treating Benjamin with this vow. Right? They are refusing to intermarry with the tribe of Benjamin. Now, of course, that should remind us of an important prohibition from the law of Moses. Because there are certain circumstances under the law, right, where the law of Moses prohibits Israel from intermarrying with certain people, like the nations of the land, right? Like the Canaanites, like the Hivites, right? Those seven nations that are named. The law prohibits, multiple times, intermarriage between Israel and them. Wayne? Yes.
You're the one that brought it on yourselves, and you're asking why? That sounds like a guilty conscience.
Yes, yes. In fact, I mean, since you've said it, I'll just go ahead and point out this: their prayer before the Lord is, again, on the face of it, it might strike us as kind of pious that, like, they're, you know, crying out to God. They are weeping. They build an altar and offer burnt offerings. But then, like, if you spend 2 seconds thinking about the content of their prayer, "Oh Lord, the God of Israel, why has this happened in Israel that today there should be one tribe lacking in Israel?" It's like, well, you just got finished killing them all. Why do you think there is a tribe lacking in Israel? Like, these guys, it's nuts. They've just finished going around burning down all of the towns in Benjamin that they could find. And then they turn around and ask, "Oh, Lord, why has this happened?" It's just ridiculous. Go ahead.
It seems to me, maybe I'm picking up on something. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether it was there or not, but they slaughtered all the women.
At least that's the way that they act. We're going to say more about that in just a minute.
So let's
hold on to that for just a second. That's the way that they're acting. We're going to have a lot more to say about that. So notice again, Israel is already just acting, I don't know, like they're just living upside down. Because they've created this problem, and they turn to the Lord and ask, "Oh, why are we suffering this problem?" And they themselves have sworn, right, "We're not going to give our daughters in marriage to Benjamin." They are treating Benjamin the same way that they're supposed to treat the nations that inhabit the land. But how have they treated the nations that inhabit the land? With kid gloves. They've not driven them out, right? We even have an example over the course of this book of one of the judges intermarrying with the heathen. You've got Samson marrying the Timnite woman. You have his relationship with Delilah, which we're not told explicitly that they were married, but probably trending in that direction. Anyway, we find, just like we saw, we talked on Thursday about how Israel draws up this huge force, 400,000 men to fight against Benjamin. It's the largest force that we find fielded in the book of Judges. They are way harsher on Benjamin than they have ever been on any of the nations that the Lord has commanded them, "You shall drive them out." Right? The rest of the nations they've been buddy-buddy with, but not Benjamin. Right? So now they see this vow as a problem, and it's only a problem, as we've said, because they have just finished prosecuting this war against Benjamin, and they are worried that Benjamin is going to go extinct. And it is ultimately because Israel has overstepped their mission in chapter 20. Right? The whole point of the war in chapter 20 was to punish who? What city is the perpetrator? Yeah, these worthless fellows in the city of Gibeah who are responsible for what happened to the Levite's concubine. All right, these are the guys that they're supposed to go in and punish. Benjamin stands up to defend them, And so, rightly, they lose in the battle ultimately. They lose the war ultimately. Right? So Israel's not wrong to burn down Gibeah. In fact, we read in verse 48, at the beginning of the verse, sorry, chapter 20, verse 48, at the beginning of the verse, the men of Israel turned back against the people of Benjamin, struck them with the edge of the sword, the city, men and beasts and all that they found, talking about Gibeah. All right, so they utterly destroy Gibeah. And again, everything up to that point, you think, okay, yeah, that's just, if Benjamin is going to field an army to defend these guys, that army deserves to be defeated in battle, right? Those soldiers who are standing up to defend them, if they die, they die, right? Israel's justified in that. Israel's justified in burning down Gibeah. But then, again, it's just a little brief note, very last statement about the war. In verse 48, all the towns they found, they set on fire. After their mission was already done, they go around just indiscriminately burning down Benjaminite towns. Now, we're not given any kind of specific details there, but notice, they have created their own problem because they did not constrain their wrath to Gibeah. And so Israel's at a point where they act and then they immediately regret the consequences of their decisions. Now they're crying out to the Lord about it. We're left to wonder, by the way, about the extent of that damage there at the end of chapter 20, because the book only tells us about the number of men who survived, right? And we emphasized that on Thursday. You've got these 600 men, these 600 veterans who returned. They survived the war. And they're all that's left of Benjamin's fighting force. We're not told about women and children, but if you listen to Israel at the beginning of chapter 21, what do they think the problem is? Do they see the problem as there's not enough men in Benjamin?
No, not
they see the problem as there's not enough women in Benjamin. Yeah, there's not enough wives for Benjamin. And I think that is an important distinction to make. See, it's something that is not necessarily drawn for us in the Hebrew, but we'll notice the way Israel gets picky about who they're going to send to Benjamin to act as wives. So, I mean, things don't exactly add up here. And again, we've learned to be skeptical about Israel over the course of the rest of the book. We're going to have more to say about all of this whenever we see their solution to this problem. But again, they understand the problem in one way, whereas it's been expressed to us in a different way at the end of chapter 20. So two more things for us to notice before we move on. First, notice that they have cried out to the Lord, but have they received an answer? No. As we've been saying, again, the book has taught us to be skeptical of these occasions where Israel seems to be humbling themselves before the Lord. We will see what kind of influence the Lord has on their decision making, if any at all. The last thing I want us to notice here in this opening passage is they have not just made that one vow at Mitzpah about giving their daughters over in marriage. They've made two vows at Mitzpah. The other vow is that anyone who didn't join their coalition at Mitzpah to fight against Benjamin would be put to death. All right, so that's noted here in verse 5. Nothing comes of it yet. We're going to see the fruits of that vow in the very next passage. So let's continue into verse 8. And they said, "What one is there of the tribes of Israel that did not come up to the Lord to Mitzpah? And behold, no one had come to the camp from Jabesh-Gilead to the assembly. For when the people were mustered, behold, not one of the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead was there. So the congregation sent 12,000 of their bravest men there and commanded them, 'Go and strike the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead with the edge of the sword, also the women and the little ones. This is what you shall do. Every male and every woman that is lain with a male, you shall devote to destruction. And they found among the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead 400 young virgins who had not known a man by lying with him, and they brought them to the camp at Shiloh, which is in the land of Canaan. Then the whole congregation sent word to the people of Benjamin who were at the rock of Rimmon and proclaimed peace to them. And Benjamin returned at that time, and they gave them the women whom they had saved alive of the women of Jabesh-Gilead, but they were not enough for them. And the people had compassion on Benjamin because the Lord had made a breach in the tribes of Israel. All right, so Israel decides here that they're going to kill two birds with one stone. They're going to enforce both oaths at the same time. They're going to enforce their oath against those who didn't participate, and at the same time, they're going to procure wives from Benjamin in such a way that doesn't technically violate their oath against intermarrying with Benjamin. And notice, again, Israel's at a point here where not only are they doing things that they immediately regret, they are also now resorting to doing things that don't technically violate their rash oaths. They're looking for technicalities, ways around, you know, getting around their word. When again, the law provides them with an option for dealing with this rash vow, right? But they're going it on their own here. Things are pretty quickly spiraling out of control for Israel. Israel is now destroying another Israelite city to cover for the problems that they created in their first attack. And for the first time since chapter 1, I don't know if you noticed this language as we were reading through, for the first time since chapter 1, we find Israel devoting a city to destruction. All right, it's in Hebrew, we would see our old friend from the book of Joshua, the word harem. It completely devoted to destruction. In chapter 1, we saw Judah devote a particular city to destruction, and that city's name becomes Hormah later on, because it comes from the same Hebrew root as harem. The name of that city becomes devoted to destruction. Right, that's the only other time in the book of Judges that we find this word. When you would expect, if Israel was behaving the way that it ought to have, you would expect us to see it a lot more, particularly in the way that the book talks about the judges. Right? Because who are the judges fighting against in almost every chapter? Right? You've got Canaanites, you've got Philistines, you've got Ammonites, you've got all of these heathens that are living in the land that Israel has not finished dealing with, and you would expect in each of those cases to find something, some place devoted to destruction. But you never, ever find that. It is only here, now that Israel is, I mean, Israel, again, is not even at war with itself at this point. Right? The war is over. They're just trying to clean up from the war. And in the cleanup, they turn against one of their own cities and devote it to destruction. So we keep seeing all of these instances, again, where Israel is treating itself the way that God has told them to treat the nations, whereas all through the rest of the book, they have not treated the nations in that way. We also see, once again, women being used as bargaining chips in the book, just like the Levite's concubine. Right? The Levite throws the concubine out to save his own skin. Here, Israel has got a problem, and they are going to use the women to fix the problem. All right, so the destruction of Jabesh-Gilead here spares the virgins so that they can take these virgins and give them to the men of Benjamin who have survived. And again, just think of, I mean, it should be a little galling to, well, it should be really galling to us at this point, how you've got these 600 veterans of Benjamin, you know, veterans of this war that claimed 40,000 Israelite lives, a war to defend the men of Gibeah who raped and murdered a woman. And these 600 veterans, what do they get for what they've done? They each get a virgin wife. All right, that's the justice that comes to them from Israel. Let's see. And I'm going to remind us of this a couple of times, by the way, but remember the text itself has not told us that the lack of women is even really the problem. Again, this is something we're hearing through Israel itself. Israel is ignoring the problem of a lack of men and addressing a problem of its own invention. So, now, as bad as all of this is, we learn at the end of the passage that it's not enough. All right, Israel has gone and devoted Jabesh-Gilead to destruction, and it's not enough. They have to take further action to solve their problem. And verse 15 should be possibly maybe the most galling thing that we read up to this point. The people had compassion on Benjamin because the Lord had made a breach in the tribes of Israel. So whom does Israel blame for their problem? It's God did this. We're having to clean up God's mess here. Yeah, I mean, it's a fairly common thing for people to think that they're going to clean up God's mess. Right, but look at what Israel has to do to satisfy themselves in thinking that they are cleaning up God's mess. They're going to go destroy this other city and steal all their virgin daughters to give in marriage to these veterans of Benjamin. All right, so we're ready, I think, for the final passage in the chapter. Any questions or comments before we continue on to the end of the very end of the book? Saul?
Well, I came in late, but I didn't realize the whole backdrop, because oftentimes people will point out, like in the wars when Israel takes the virgin daughters, they'll point out, well, see, look, they're taking like little girls and raping them. But I wanted to point out that in Deuteronomy 21, there's a law specifically about, you know, taking wives from spoils of war.
Yeah.
It talks about how they have to shave their head, so they have to make themselves look ugly, and they have to take off all their makeup.
Right.
They have to dress in sackcloth.
They have time to mourn.
And then they have to have 3 months to mourn their families. And then if you still want to marry her, because you have to take care of her those 3 months.
Yes.
You have to pay for her food, you have to take care of her.
Yep.
Take care of her, actually.
Yep.
And if after those 3 months, now you still want to marry her, then you can marry her.
Right.
So it's interesting.
Yeah, and it's something that
and I don't think that's probably what they weren't doing. They probably just skipped that and
we definitely don't read about that happening. There's something else to this whole thing. The law concerning harem, particularly in war, gives Israel an exemption for virgin wives. Right, so it's destroy everything, destroy all of the men, women, and children, destroy the livestock. But if you see a virgin woman there that you are interested in taking as a wife, you may. You don't have to devote her to destruction. Israel has taken that, if they're even aware of that law at this point, they have taken that and stretched it out, right, extended it, as it were. They are in devoting this city to destruction that legally they really have no business devoting to destruction, and they are preserving these women not for themselves, but to give to someone else. We find them stretching things, kind of turning themselves in pretzels to get done what they want to get done in a way that doesn't technically violate any of their principles, such as they have. All right. Any other questions or comments before we read the last section? All right. Verse 16. Then the elders of the congregation said, "What shall we do for wives for those who are left, since the women are destroyed out of Benjamin?" And they said, "There must be an inheritance for the survivors of Benjamin, that a tribe not be blotted out from Israel. Yet we cannot give them wives from our daughters. For the people of Israel had sworn, cursed be he who gives a wife to Benjamin. So they said, behold, there is the yearly feast of the Lord at Shiloh, which is north of Bethel, on the east of the highway that goes up from Bethel to Shechem, and south of Labona. And they commanded the people of Benjamin, saying, go and lie in ambush in the vineyards, and watch. If the daughters of Shiloh come out to dance in the dances, then come out of the vineyards and snatch each one his wife from the daughters of Shiloh, and go to the land of Benjamin. And when their fathers or their brothers come to complain to us, we'll say to them, grant them graciously to us, because we did not take each man of them his wife in battle. Neither did you give them to them, else you would now be guilty. And the people of Benjamin did so, and took their wives according to their number from the dancers whom they carried off. Then they went and returned to their inheritance, and rebuilt the towns and lived in them. And the people of Israel departed from there at that time, every man to his tribe and family. And they went out from there, every man to his inheritance. In those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. So, the problem is stated again. Wait, go ahead, Wayne.
This sounds so much like the old cartoon you see all the time. You know, caveman comes out, beats a girl over the head.
Yeah, drags her off to the cave.
Her hair back to his cave.
Yeah, it's like they're playing into a stereotype here. So the problem is stated again. The inheritance of Benjamin is at risk. Now, I want us to hold that description in mind, what they say in verse 17. They said, there must be an inheritance for the survivors of Benjamin. Because they've struck on the real problem there. And it's a problem that the law provides a solution for. But just like all of the other problems that Israel has created and that the law has a solution for, they will not pursue the law's solution. They're coming up with their own solutions for things. All right, but again, they restate this problem. The inheritance is in danger, but we have vowed not to give our daughters in marriage to Benjamin. So what are we going to do to supply more women to Benjamin? And so Israel comes up with yet another cockamamie scheme to solve their problem, since their first plan of destroying Jabesh-Gilead didn't fully work. Again, they are resorting to things that only don't technically violate their rash vow. Right? We've said that we won't give our daughters in marriage, but what if Benjamin were to take them, kidnap them, steal them? We wouldn't be giving them then. And so, we keep our vow, they get their wives. Right, they do this, again, rather than deal with the rash vow itself. And they've gone completely off the rails. Notice the occasion that they use for this. All right, we're going to stage this wife stealing when? In verse 19. Behold, there is the yearly feast of the Lord at Shiloh, which is north of Bethel, on the east of the highway that goes up from Bethel to Shechem and south of Labona. They are using one of the feasts of obligation, which one we're not told, as an opportunity to stage this wife stealing. Remember, the law provides three feasts, feasts of obligation, where the sons of Israel have to go up to the Lord wherever he causes his name to dwell. At this time, it's in Shiloh. They have to go up, present themselves before the Lord, offer sacrifices, and participate in the feast. Do you all remember which three feasts you have to go up for every year? A little Bible trivia for you.
Well, one was booths.
Yes, the Feast of Booths, or the Feast of Tabernacles, what you'll hear modern-day Jews refer to as Sukkot, where they go out and they have to build themselves a tent to live in to remind... What's the point of them building a tent to live in during that feast? Y'all know? Yes, exactly. They had to live in tents during their time in the wilderness. It's a reminder of the Exodus. a reminder of God's salvation, a reminder of God's provision for them in the wilderness. That's a big part of Sukkot. All right, what other feasts did they have to come up for every year? What? Passover, or the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Right? Those two feasts are associated very closely with one another, and sometimes they're referred to as one, sometimes referred to as the other. But they have to come up every year for the Feast of Unleavened Bread and the Passover, which is also a reminder of the Exodus, also a reminder of God's salvation, God's protection and provision over them. The other one is the Feast of Pentecost, right? They're the Feast of Weeks, which is a grain harvest feast. So it's during one of those three, we're not told which, during one of those three feasts, when everybody's gone up to Shiloh, Benjamin is supposed to, you know, the men of Benjamin hang out in the bushes, you know, being creepy, watching these women come out to dance, and then they dash out, they snatch whichever one looks good to them, and they run off back to Benjamin, and again, this is a staged kidnapping so that they have wives. So Israel is using one of these feasts as an occasion for a wife stealing. And yet again, we find Israel using their women as bargaining chips. In the case of Jabesh-Gilead, they at least came up with an excuse. This is a bad excuse, but they came up with an excuse for why they should take the daughters of Jabesh-Gilead to be brides for the Benjaminites. Here, they don't have any kind of excuse at all. They are just throwing Shiloh under the bus. All right, and remember, Shiloh is the place where the Lord is causing his name to dwell. All right, this is where the priestly family is stationed at this time. And they are throwing Shiloh under the bus. All right, so we can sum up everything that has happened here over the course of these three chapters. The city of Gibeah rapes a woman to death after seeking to rape a Levite to death. Israel's solution to this was to cut the woman up, to sack a bunch of Benjaminite villages, killing an untold number of women. Right? They're acting as though they killed all the women in Benjamin. Now, I doubt that that's the case. Again, at this point, we don't trust Israel as far as we can throw them. But if they're right, if we do trust them, that's awful. They've killed all the women of this tribe over this one woman who was raped to death. They then turn around and sack Jabesh-Gilead, killing more women and taking the virgin women captive to give as wives to the men who survived the war, defending the men who raped the Levite's concubine. And then they turn around and look the other way while Benjamin is kidnapping more women to be their wives. This is how you defend women in Israel at this time. Now, I've been talking about things as though Israel has misidentified the real problem and the real solution. They've come close to identifying the real problem when they say that there must be an inheritance for the survivors of Benjamin, because that's a legitimate concern of the law. You should remember, I think, the laws of levirate marriage. So if a man dies and leaves no son, no heir to receive his inheritance, what is his closest kin supposed to do? Like, what's his brother supposed to do? Yeah, he's supposed to provide an heir for his dead brother so that his house, his name, is not cut off from Israel. The case of Benjamin here, I think, admittedly, is kind of difficult because, we don't know how many women there are left after the Civil War in chapter 20. All right, if Israel actually did kill all the women in the entire tribe of Benjamin, then figuring out a good solution, I think, maybe becomes a little more difficult. But if there were any widows left, if there were any women left, the pretty clear solution to this problem is for Israel to provide sons to them to carry on their inheritance. But as we have seen in the law, you remember the story of Onan, the son of Judah. Right, providing a son to be the heir for somebody else is expensive and risky, and men in the ancient world generally don't want to do it. Here, we're talking about having to do that on a tribe-wide scale, provide sons to an entire tribe. And so instead of doing that, Israel kidnaps wives for the 600 veterans. All right, but they've got things backwards. Right? The law tells them to provide sons. They are worried about providing daughters. And their wife-stealing solution does not solve the basic problem caused by the war, that potentially thousands of names, thousands of fathers' houses, thousands of households are cut off and left without an inheritance in Israel. It's implied that these 600 surviving veterans, that their surviving households just come into all of that inheritance. Right? That rather than having these the inheritance of Benjamin split among these thousands of households, it's split among only 600 men. Then there are no heirs provided for all of the ones who died in chapter 20. But everybody goes home. They're all satisfied that they have solved this problem that the Lord has made. It is a complete shambles. And so really the only possible way to close a story this sordid is with what it says in verse 25. In those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. All right, we are out of time. I want to thank you so much for participating so much, joining so well in this study of Judges. I hope that this has been enlightening. I know Judges, again, in total is a sordid book. There's very little encouragement in this book. We will, Lord willing, after I return from Illinois, we will get a more positive story from the time of the Judges as we look at the book of Ruth. But we are done with Judges for now. So,
Caleb, will there be Bible this Thursday or not?
Yes. Yeah, Jason's going to be filling in this Thursday. So we've got fill-ins set up for everything over the next few services while we're gone. So. No, Jason's got his own program set up for the next 3 days. All right. So thank you so much for your kind attention and your questions and comments through all of this.